It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, little green men taught me how to do the bop. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be talking about life beyond the bounds of Earth.
Yeah, which we've talked about in a couple of episodes before, but we're specifically talking about how do we search for life and be sure that we found it and that it definitely came from capital somewhere, capital else.
Yeah, we're not just talking about alien life, but alien life that we definitely didn't put there.
Yeah. So this is important because of multiple things. One, we're very curious about whether or not there is life outside of our planet. The odds are pretty good, considering the vastness of the universe, that life also exists somewhere else. Whether it exists somewhere within our detectable range of view is another question. And then we also are hoping to maybe even learn more about the origins of life on Earth, particularly from any indications of life on our nearby neighboring planetary and moon bodies, right?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that would be interesting would be if you go to other objects in the solar system and you find life forms there that are based in DNA, you could say, aha, ooh, this may be a piece of evidence for the theory that DNA precedes the evolution of, or the origin of all life.
Exactly.
Right? The DNA is a necessary component. You didn't have it the other way around. You didn't have life that it eventually got DNA as a molecule. But there's another way you could read finding life with DNA, which is that what if it just came from some other DNA-based life?
Right. What if we also thought we had discovered the smoking DNA gun on a surface such as Mars, only to find out, much to our chagrin later on, that whoops-a-daisy, It actually hitched a ride on the very probe we sent there, and in fact came from, you know, Dubuque.
Dubuque? Why Dubuque?
Just random place.
Well, then okay. Let's say it came from Peoria.
Okay. Or Kalamazoo, Michigan.
No matter where it comes from, this is more than just a problem of, like, corrupting our data samples and our senses of childlike wonder. You know, if we bring Earth life along with us to a place, how can we be sure that we won't be committing unintentional genocide on whatever life forms might happen to be native to that place to begin with?
Right. So this is sort of the problem of something like kudzu here in the southeast, right? Mm-hmm. Kudzu is not native to the southeast United States, but anyone who has spent any time, particularly north of Atlanta, is very familiar with kudzu. It's this creeping vine. It was brought in specifically to try and help curtail erosion on hillsides. I know this because the place where I grew up, absolutely covered in kudzu. It
you
took
know,
over.
One place I very often see it, especially in my hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee, when I go back there, is in like former construction sites and digging sites, places where there have been large sections of earth carried away by earth movers or flattened. Then there will, you know, years later be kudzu all over it.
I specifically remember a telephone pole outside of Oakwood, Georgia, which is where I grew up, that because of the way the vines had grown up the pole and along some of the wires, it looked like Godzilla. And so we called it Kudzilla. And but nice. The point that I'm making here is that kudzu is an invasive species that has killed a lot of the native plants by covering them up. You know, it's competing for the same resources, right?
Mm-hmm. And so, it's really effective at growing.
Exactly. So the fear is that we could potentially bring something from Earth to another planet where it would be capable of adapting to those conditions and edging out any sort of indigenous life.
Yeah, and this is the subject that we're going to be talking about today. It typically goes under the name interplanetary contamination.
Exactly.
For the process. And we're also going to be talking about the process of trying to prevent this, which is often known as planetary protection.
Yeah, it's sort of like a microbial version of the Prime Directive. The Prime Directive, of course, being in Star Trek, the thing where you say that you will do no harm.
Right.
You will not interact with other stuff
out there,
with other life forms out there, unless, like, it's really important or there's, like, a chick you want to get up with. Or,
right,
like,
exactly.
Or whatever,
unless the plot calls for it, right?
Yeah, right. Totally. But on a microbial level, you know, that's basically the same thing.
Yeah, so we're not talking about bringing life forms, like, multicellular complex organisms like rabbits and rhinos.
Yeah, the probe isn't going to be having an infestation of badgers somewhere
in
it.
I mean, honey badgers are a real problem, especially in Far Cry 4. But
maybe water bears, though.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
But we're specifically talking about microbial life.
Or things that aren't even life yet, but would be very interesting if we were to find them in a place other than Earth. Like,
sure.
Like what they call organic molecules.
Right, mm-hmm. the building blocks that indicate perhaps the presence or the one-time presence of life. It may be that the things we discover on other planets aren't life, but are rather remnants of what used to be life.
Sure. Or you know, right, all that DNA stuff that we were talking about earlier in this very episode and also for a couple episodes before this, you know, either amino acids or nucleobases, nucleotides, whatever you want to call them, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
something as simple as methane.
Right, sure. Yeah, something that's
considered an organic molecule.
Exactly. So interplanetary contamination, it actually works both ways. We'll talk about that a little bit more later on, but there is like forward contamination and backward contamination, and that essentially means are we taking stuff to another planet or are we bringing stuff back to our planet from somewhere else? But interplanetary contamination is a big deal. I mean, it's something that lots of smart people have talked about, and in fact, there are agreements between nations not to do that thing. The Outer Space Treaty, which we have talked about multiple times on this show, right? We've talked about Outer Space Treaty as far as it goes with the idea of can you own property in space?
Right.
The idea that the moon is no one's property just because you put a flag there.
The answer is yes, you can if you buy it from me.
Right. If you're not too upset about handing money over to a total scam artist, you too can own landscape on the moon. So for the Outer Space Treaty actually has a section that covers the idea of interplanetary contamination, and it specifically reads states parties to the treaty shall pursue studies of outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, and conduct exploration of them so as to avoid their harmful contamination and also adverse changes in the environment of the Earth resulting from the introduction of extraterrestrial matter, and where necessary shall adopt appropriate measures for this purpose. Now, that's specifically backwards contamination.
Well, it mentions both. It mentions forward and backward contamination. So it says that we will avoid, quote, their harmful contamination, they're referring to the moon and other celestial bodies.
Sure.
And then it also says, don't mess up Earth when you come back, which is what happens, of course, in Dawn of the Dead, or not Night of the Living Dead.
Yes, exactly.
A space probe returning from Venus comes into the atmosphere, and then
oops.
And then
hilarity ensues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some sleepy people decide to have a party.
They're coming to get you, Barbara. In addition, the Committee on Space Research, also known as COSPAR, has created the COSPAR Planetary Protection Policy, using the Outer Space Treaty as sort of their starting point.
And here in the United States, NASA has a division that's dedicated to this pursuit as well. It's called the Planetary Protection Office. Its slogan is, all of the planets, all of the time. which, you know, isn't ambitious at all. You know, like no pressure there, NASA.
You can fool all of the planets some of the time. But, and some of the planets all the time, but you can't fool all the planets all the time.
Also, it just reminds me of that hyperbole and a half quote, just clean all the things, like clean all the planets.
Yes, but so we mentioned there are two main types of planetary contamination. It can be either going out or coming in.
Yeah, so the going out part we'll talk about in more detail soon. The coming back part, that's something that's already happened, right? We brought samples back from the moon.
Sure.
If you believe NASA that we've been there.
Well, I mean, I want to put you in a very very frustrating scenario. Imagine you have just been to outer space.
Right.
And you made it back to Earth safely, and you're like, oh, my God, I went to outer space.
I want a cheeseburger.
I explored space. I survived.
Yeah, like, I want some mac and cheese. I want to hug my dog. Like,
right. No, nope. You are going to sit in a container and wait for a long time.
For, like, a month. Yeah, so in the Apollo missions, the returning equipment and astronauts had to undergo a 30-day quarantine period after each mission, just to make certain that nothing brought back would be harmful to life here on Earth, because you can't be too careful. You know, it was people were pretty sure that there wouldn't be anything incredibly dangerous, but you don't know. It may be that the soils would have contained some sort of highly dangerous carcinogen or something.
Yeah, better safe than sorry.
Yeah.
This is funny. I mean, what I just said was based on what the Apollo astronauts had to do. What is the process now? So let's say you return from the ISS. Do you have to go through quarantine today?
I'm sure there's a period of observation, but it's like a couple of days. I don't think it's as long as 30 days, because you're not typically bringing anything back with you that's extraterrestrial in nature, right? You are aboard the ISS.
Yeah.
Now, there might be some pretty far out people on the ISS, but they aren't so far out as to be none of this Earth.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. And as long as you're not demonstrating like a clear case of space madness.
Oh, that just takes me back to Ren and Stimpy.
Exactly.
With the creamy nougaty center. obviously,
I sense the basis of a good creepypasta.
Yeah. Obviously, we'd also love to get our hands on any kind of life that originated from outside of the Earth. But if we were to do so,
maybe not our hands,
our grimy, grimy hands,
but our metaphorical hands.
Yeah,
good grief.
I get you.
Millennials
our
are so literal.
Complex instrumentation hands.
Right. So we'd love to be able to take possession of life that originated from outside of our own planetary home.
Yeah.
Right. But that obviously could come with a substantial risk, lots of different risks. We could, in fact, have the opposite of what we were talking about earlier, where, you know, if we were to bring something from Earth to another planet and it were to really multiply in an uncontrollable fashion, same thing could potentially happen, bringing something from another planet back here on Earth, and that could be bad. Yeah. So most people say that the obvious solution for that is to use a system of containment, that you never allow whatever it was you brought back from another planet to escape a controlled, contained, you know, facility. So, which makes perfect sense. You know, you wouldn't be like, hey, we found Martian daisies. Let's plant it on Earth and see what happens.
You wouldn't want that to happen. Let's put it next to all of our major food crops.
There's a school right down the road that would really use some beautification.
Excellent,
so.
Yes.
Oh, the Martian daisies are eating all the small animals. That's probably not anything to worry about, you know, and then you get some horrible science fiction film. And there are a couple different scenarios. We sort of mentioned the different ideas. One is that we send a probe out to another celestial body, and we end up getting some sort of result that suggests that, yes, we've found life, or we found organic compounds that suggest the presence of life, only to find out that, oops, we may have brought that with us.
Yeah.
So that's one of the
scenarios. Really frustrating uncertainty.
Yeah. And it's something that's happened. It's not like this is new, this or just a theory or
hypothetical.
Hypothesis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then there's also the scenario that we've mentioned before. We send a probe there. It brings some sort of organic material, life forms, to a distant body, and then they flourish there and edge out any life or eradicate any signs of life on that planet, and then we never know if life was there or not.
Maybe our microbes are like the Europa version of the alien xenomorphs. Maybe like everything that they exhale is just acid and it's terrible.
Yeah. But I mean, wouldn't it be fun to find out? Then scenario three, of course, is that we send some sort of probe or mission someplace. It comes back and then we get space mono. And there's a George Romero film that breaks out as a result,
right.
Which, while it sounds groovy, is probably not something you actually want to live through. I mean, you want to live through it, but you don't want to experience it.
Right. It's preferable overall. If it's going to happen,
you want to live through
it. Maybe you want to live through it. I don't know.
I mean, it really depends. I mean, season two of Walking Dead, you probably just wanted to be like, just end it.
I didn't want to live through that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got this concern that we've articulated now that there are multiple reasons we might want to be concerned about microbial life being transported from one planetary body or solar system object to another.
Right.
And we can all pretty much agree that that's something that could possibly happen and that we should be concerned about. But how concerned about it should we be?
Well, I mean, we've already seen people say we cannot allow something like the Curiosity rover to make its way over to locations that are theoretically at least within its range of roving to check out potential water because of these very concerns, right?
Mm-hmm. Because so, we know that there's stuff on the Curiosity and that we don't want.
Yeah, that the Curiosity wasn't completely sterile.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So because of that, we cannot allow the Curiosity rover to come in contact with a water supply and potentially contaminate it. So it's very frustrating because you could see where the water is and the rover is within range of it. And if you could just get over there and do some measurements,
legally speaking,
you might even be able to tell if there is life or evidence of past life within that area where there's water. I mean, that seems like that's going to be our best option of finding something close to the surface of Mars, but we can't do it. So that's one reason people are concerned about it, because we've already kind of seen the limitation of what we're able to do with the tools that are on Mars right now. There's also a pressing concern that the agreements we talked about, that official space treaty, that's an agreement between nations, between governments. Mm-hmm. It's not an agreement between private industries.
As many wannabe asteroid miners have frequently reminded us.
Yeah. So private industry isn't beholden to those same restrictions and could potentially go and muck everything up for everybody.
The private space industry, by the way, is poised to get huge, or huger, like soon. We've talked about that asteroid exploration thing before and about Mars One before, and I'm pretty sure that Mars One is super defunct at this point. But an announcement from SpaceX this very week, the last week of April, indicates that private Mars exploration in general is certainly not dead. Elon Musk really wants to send an unpersoned Dragon 2 spacecraft, which is the upcoming descendant of the Dragon 1 spacecraft, to Mars in 2018. 2018, y'all. That's like so soon.
Yeah.
And he's putting the pressure on because in 2018, Mars will be just 35.8 million miles away from Earth. And that is the closest we will be to the red planet between now and 2035. Mm. So 2018 might be when private spacecraft touches down on Mars. Hat tip, by the way, to Robert Lamb and How Stuff Works Now, a new video and podcast series from How Stuff Works for covering that particular topic.
Yeah, I've actually heard that, and I don't know if this was a joke or not, but someone on Twitter said, did you know Elon Musk wants to retire on Mars? And I was thinking, is this real? And I never bothered to actually check, but it totally sounds like something he would say, even if it were just in
even
jest.
Even if it were kind of a joke. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So the point here is that if we are going to legislate private companies about this kind of stuff, we should probably get on that like yesterday.
Yeah, because obviously these concerns we're talking about, if you want to answer some pretty big questions like, was there ever life on Mars? Is there still life on Mars and other celestial bodies? We're using Mars because that's probably the one that we're going to be hitting first. But there are other, like, there are certain other moons in the solar system that are also potential targets for where we think life is most likely to exist if it exists elsewhere in our solar system. But can we get some legislation in there so that we make sure we don't destroy that evidence before we have a chance to actually look for it?
Well, this sort of leads us to the question of what we can actually do to prevent it. I mean, just short of not ever going to any other objects in the solar
right,
system. If we're going to be – right, yeah. If we're going to be conjugating with other objects in our solar system, exploring them or even colonizing them, is it just inevitable that we're going to contaminate them with our microbes, or – are there steps we can take to reasonably with reasonable confidence say that we're not doing that?
Right, because legislation is lovely, but the practical scientific end has to come up with a practical scientific way of making that go.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Spoiler alert, folks, because I'm just going to go ahead and tell you right now. There is no way that we can be 100% certain that we can explore and certainly not colonize another planet or moon without contaminating it to some degree.
Womp womp.
Yeah, the real question is, how bad would it be? We don't know. But if you're going to be bringing, like, especially for colonization, if you're going to be bringing a whole bunch of stuff with you that has organic material involved in it, like food and, you know, us, then not us in this room. I'm not going. But, you know, human beings.
Well. That's colonization. Maybe we should take a step back first and look at exploration.
Yeah, sure. I mean, even just a rover, as we are apt to send out to places we have not been before. And you know, so when we want things to not have bacteria on them, we usually sterilize them, and that seems like a pretty good thing. Like every time I go in to get another facial tattoo, like, you know, there's some kind of sterilization system in place.
Yeah. Right.
We can
somebody blows the cockroach parts off of the needle.
Yeah, yeah. And we can blow the cockroach parts off of rovers as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was
remind me not to go to your tattoo artist.
So I was wondering how space agencies do this, and I looked it up. Actually, NASA has a page that's pretty interesting where it explains its own strategies for sterilizing equipment specifically bound for Mars through the Mars Exploration Rover programs, and that would include Spirit and Opportunity. So objects we put on Mars, we had to sterilize them before they went. How did we do that? So this is funny. They had a mandate to carry, quote, no more than 300,000 bacterial spores on any surface from which the spores could get into the Martian environment.
I just imagine that some poor schmo's job.
Who's got to count them?
Right, 299,999. Oh, man.
But
come on.
That's interesting. The mandate is not perfectly sterile. It's no more than 300,000 spores.
Well, it's just like, you know. No box of cereal is completely without rat hair.
That's true. Yeah, you got to have a little, you know, one part per million. That's not so bad.
Yeah.
So they've got that mandate, but how do they actually accomplish it? Well, while the spacecraft are being assembled, first of all, technicians are going to be constantly wiping down surfaces with alcohol solution. This is sort of stage one. You're constantly wiping alcohol on them to sterilize the surfaces. kill whatever microbes are there. Mm-hmm. They also conduct microbiology samples to make sure there aren't too many organisms present on the surfaces at multiple stages along the construction of these spacecraft. And then they take all of the heat-tolerant components, which aren't all of the components, but it's, you know, a lot of the outer ones.
Sure.
The heat-tolerant components, and they heat them to 110 degrees Celsius or 230 degrees Fahrenheit. And then they've also got a central box containing the rover's computer and main electronic components, and that's kept sealed, and all the ventilated air that goes through it is heavily filtered to make sure that if you've got any microorganisms inside the electronics box, they don't get out once they're on the other
planet.
They're
in little microbe jail.
Yeah. Microbe jail forever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
And then they also say that on this mission, they went out of the way to prevent any non-sterilized part of the launch vehicle from accidentally getting to Mars, which I thought was interesting. That this is something you'd actually have to worry about, but they did. Because so think about it like this. As the rocket launches, it at several stages has to separate from a stage of its launch vehicle.
Right.
You know, it discards part of the rocket and throws it away. And the last part of the rocket that it discards, the third stage of the Delta launch vehicle, is going to be on the trajectory with the spacecraft heading out of orbit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just left it like that, the last part of the rocket that it separates with would basically be on a course to follow the spacecraft to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead what they do is they start their journey going the wrong way, not totally the wrong way, but not quite on a direct trajectory to hit Mars, so that if they separate and the object follows them, the launch vehicle part will float off in that direction. And then after 10 days, they make a course correction to meet Mars in its orbit.
Hmm. That's good, because it reminds me of that picture of the rocket taking off and the little frog attached mm-hmm. to the rocket, and we could have ended up with the frog on Mars.
Right, but not with this program.
No.
Right.
That frog is lost in space.
Now, apparently for some past probes, like the Viking lander, they had an even higher standard of sterility, which was pretty much actual, like, full sterilization. They would blast the whole thing in a high-temperature oven for several days.
Yeah, the numbers that I read were 111.7 degrees Celsius for 30 hours.
But the electronics on the most recent probes probably could not stand up to that.
No, they're not quite the same caliber as the ones from the Viking.
Yeah, so we go through actually less rigorous sterilization on planetary rovers and probes than we used to.
Right. Now, here's the thing, is that Not all the stuff we've sent out has been completely sterilized.
Right.
Even when your sterilization method is effective and you're reasonably sure that you're below that 300,000 bacterial spores metric,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't magically clean off all the organic carbon molecules that may or may not be attached to that material.
Right.
Those could still be on the probe. Which, if there are enough of them, it could be enough to throw off our instrumentation and give you a false positive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still the possibility that stuff that isn't actually life, but rather are the building blocks for life here on Earth, could hitch a ride. And even if you've done the sterilization approach, they could throw things off, because it's the same sort of stuff as what you're looking for when you're doing these particular types of experiments.
Right, right.
Now, one of the ways we could try to limit this possibility is to go to these places but not actually land on them, to do essentially flybys, orbits, that kind of stuff, look at the various bodies from a distance. And the problem with that method, of course, is that you can see a lot of things from a distance that indicate the building blocks for life. But unless you're catching space people going to the space mall on your camera, you're probably not close enough to actually get a real idea.
The problem with not landing on a planet is that you're not landing on it.
Yeah.
Right.
You're not able to physically interact with the environment and either verify or discard a hypothesis, right? Like, without actually landing and taking samples and testing those samples, you can just make a kind of educated guess. And even
it's
then,
kind of like saying, I want you to meet my friend, but you can only drive around the block around his house.
Right. Now, you might see
which is
that
just creepy when you think about
you
it.
You might see that lights are on in the house, and you may draw the conclusion, well, that Joe's friend is probably home. Or you might see that all the lights are off, and you think Joe's friend is either not home or is asleep, essentially, right? Yeah. Like, there's certain things, there's certain conclusions you can draw, but you're not 100% certain of any of them.
Yeah.
Right.
Same thing as problematic with this.
Unless you honk your horn really loud and Joe's friend comes out of the house and shakes his fist at you.
Right. If you were to honk your horn at Mars or one of the moons out there that we suspect could potentially house life, and little microbes came out and formed a giant, like, emoji-like picture, then that would work. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
that would work.
That would be something. Somehow, I don't think that's a highly likely scenario.
No. So,
crush all of my dreams, Joe.
Another thing we could try to do is reduce contamination to a level that's below the precision of our instrumentation. So, in other words, be reasonably sure that the amount of stuff from Earth that is attached to a probe is so minute, there's so little of it, that it is unlikely the instrumentation aboard the probe would even detect it. So if we were to detect any organic compounds, it would likely be from wherever we sent the probe, rather than from Earth itself. Problem is, we're getting better and better at making sensitive instrumentation, so it requires cleaner and cleaner probes to make absolutely certain that it's not an Earth-bound or Earth-originated organic compound that we're picking up, as opposed to something from Mars or wherever.
Another difficult thing to design a test for is whether the sterilization that we've done on a spacecraft has gotten it truly clean. And this is especially true in the 1970s. Like, we're learning a little bit better now, but it's real hard to test the cleanliness of an object, because most lab procedures for testing microbial contamination revolve around culturing samples of the material to see if anything grows in those lab cultures. Mm-hmm. And lots of microbes really resist being cultured in labs. I mean, I wouldn't want to reproduce in a lab either, so I understand. So that method might not be a good indication of what contamination we might be sending out, and especially what contamination we might have sent out in the past.
Now, this tells me that some microbes are a lot like some Atlantans. They really, really resist getting cultured.
Oh.
Theater jokes. Okay, so if we go back to the other half of that, colonizing. Now, clearly, we've already said that just sending an unmanned probe or rover or whatever is, and making certain that we do not contaminate the destination, is already really hard. It's an order of magnitude harder to do that as a colonization mission, right?
Right. Well, I mean, anywhere we go where we're going to be pooping, we will probably start to run into this problem.
And wherever we go, let's be honest, we will poop. We're going to be pooping there.
Yeah. Exactly right. Right. I mean, we're going to be eating and pooping and all sorts, doing all the human things at that, because that's what humans do at that location. And unless you've created a habitat that is completely sealed off from the surrounding environment, to the point where you even begin to question, why did we come here?
Right.
Yeah, it's like going to an exotic location and staying inside your hotel room the whole time. I mean, what's the point at that stage?
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't that be the most hilarious conundrum if we do discover some kind of microbial life on Mars and we're like 40% sure it didn't come from poop, but it might have come from poop.
Right. Yeah, this is why we have to be thankful that The Martian is just a work of fiction, because otherwise Mark Watley ruined it for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting also, this is not just the plot to The Martian, it's also the plot to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, or at least part of the plot. So stick with me here, because this is actually, it's instrumental to things that happen. If it weren't for the fact that the Federation also wanted to make absolutely certain that any experiments involving terraforming, in this case, not colonizing or anything like that, but terraforming a planet, did not destroy any life forms at all. If it weren't for that fact, there wouldn't have been a story to the movie, because what happens is Commander Pavel Chekhov goes along with the crew of the USS Reliant. He is no longer part of the Enterprise crew. He's on the Reliance crew.
Right.
And they go to I think SETI Alpha 5. They don't know that it's SETI Alpha 5, But they go to SETI Alpha 5, which happens to be where Khan has been
chilling,
marooned for the last several years.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, Khan recognizes Chekhov, despite the fact that Chekhov was not part of the crew in Space Seed, the episode that Khan showed up in. But never mind that. At any rate, so they go there because they're looking for a planet that is devoid of life in order to use it as a testing facility for the Genesis Project, which is this terraforming project, right? And if it weren't for the idea that we have to find a lifeless planet, the rest of the movie never would have happened. Now, granted, they actually go down, beam down to the surface of the planet to check, which might not be the best way to avoid bringing life to a lifeless planet.
But... No. By the, what is it, the 24th century, humans no longer shed skin cells.
Right, or poop.
Or poop, or breathe, or, you know, anything like that.
All those organic functions that we used to have. That's so 21st century.
Yeah.
So, what happens in the movie, of course, is they test the Genesis Project, and discover that it can turn a dead planet into a lush, life-supporting world in a matter of hours, which is essentially the stuff of magic. We have no technology even remotely close to being able to do that. But it is interesting that it was related to the topic we're talking about right now. But that leads us to another question. Okay, science fiction aside, is this something that we should actually be concerned about in the first place? Is it as big a deal as the Outer Space Treaty and these various organizations would have us believe? And that depends upon whom you ask.
Yeah.
You know, there's a Nature Geoscience ran a couple of different articles on this very subject. And the first one was written by Alberto G. Firin, and I'm probably butchering the names, I apologize, and Dirk Scholz-Makusch, who published a piece titled The Overprotection of Mars. And in that article, they argued that we're making way too big a deal about possibly contaminating the red planet. And their arguments were numerous. One of them was that...
The way you said that with your tone, you make it sound like they're like, what the heck.
I admit, I get
poop rockets right over there.
I get really cavalier in this section because I don't agree with their perspective.
Oh.
But I should say that their paper is not written in the snarky tone that my notes are written in.
I think they make some good points.
Yeah, me too.
There's some decent points. They say that the restrictions are making it very difficult to explore Mars, and we've said there's a case for that. The Curiosity rover example is an actual real historical example we could point to. And they argue that we're holding back scientific progress in an effort to protect something that might not even be there. They also say it adds to the expense of these missions to make certain that the stuff we send up is sterilized. And they say, hey, you know what? Science has shown that it's pretty plausible that life could cling to a rock that's been jettisoned into space through some event and then travel to another planet and then survive the trip down to that planet. And since that does seem to be possible, it's probably true that tons of Earth microbes over the millennia have already gone to Mars through natural means. And that means that they're already there. The Earth microbes that we're so worried about bringing to Mars have been there for millions of years.
We've definitely found bits of what we're pretty sure are Mars stuff here on Earth, resulting from what we assume were primordial impacts. There's no reason to think the bits of Earth that broke off after meteors or asteroids or comets or whatever impacted us would not have similarly made their way over to Mars and to other planets in the solar system and et cetera. Maybe before the building blocks of life and or early forms of life happened here, but maybe after. Without a time machine that's way more advanced than the Wayback Machine, we may never know.
Yeah.
Also, even if those rock samples that we found are not bits of Mars, we're really pretty sure that like some 40 kilograms and or 88 pounds of Martian micrometeorites land here on Earth every year.
Yeah.
So this kind of transfer happens.
Also, I mean, depending on even if we don't see it very often, when you think about it over geological time or the age of the solar system, transfer of matter between planetary bodies probably happens fairly frequently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. On that scale, certainly.
If we're imagining there's a case where microbial life can be transported from one body to the other and then survive for a significant amount of time once it gets there, I mean, not like dying 18 hours after it arrives on Mars, then that's probably already happened.
Yeah.
And speaking about dying 18 hours after it arrives on Mars, one of the other arguments they said is, hey, Mars might really suck if you're a living thing. Like,
well, that's almost beyond a speculation. I mean, Mars would suck, but
for life
again,
as we know it, Mars is crappy.
Yeah. For our style of living. I mean, I'm not a particularly lush, luxurious kind of guy, but even for me, Mars is a little sparse for my tastes.
Right. But then again, we don't know. I mean, life finds a way.
Yeah. So they said that if Mars is at a point where it cannot sustain Earth life, then microbes probably wouldn't survive very long on the Martian surface. Ancient Earth life, assuming some had actually landed on the planet in the past, probably died out once the conditions on Mars became too hostile. It probably adapted for a while, and then once it reached a certain point, could no longer survive. And any life form from Earth today would die out pretty quickly due to those same conditions. So bring all the Earth life you like. It's not going to have a chance to contaminate anything. It'll die first. Mm-hmm. Or, they argue, it's possible that Mars could support Earth-like life on it.
And in which case, all that stuff that's been going that we just talked about that's been going there over the geological time.
Yeah, it means
has
that
it's already contaminated.
It's already there, right? Mm-hmm. And that Martian and Earth life may have coexisted for millions of years at this point, or it could be that one had replaced the other. It's impossible to know.
I mean, there's even a hypothesis that's popular that says that Earth life may have come from Mars.
Sure.
It's not like we have strong evidence for this, but it's a possibility that's taken seriously.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if you look at that argument, they're essentially saying so either Mars can't support Earth life, in which case there's no issue, or Mars can support Earth life, in which case it's already there. So contaminating is a non-problem. Stop making us worry about it. We want to send stuff up there like crazy. Then in the subsequent edition of Nature Geoscience, Catherine A. Conley and John D. Rummel wrote a rebuttal titled Appropriate Protection of Mars. So you can probably tell from the title that they disagreed with the previous argument. They also, by the way, were part of these organizations we were talking about earlier. So, you know, they have a specific point of view on this.
Yeah. But I mean, good point they might bring up here. What about science?
Yeah. They said that those protective measures, while certainly comprehensive, are vital if we are to understand the potential for life on Mars, as well as gain insight to the origins of life on Earth. If we do contaminate Mars with Earth life, then we never are able to answer definitively the question, was there life on Mars? If so, did it share a common ancestor with life on Earth? Was it in fact the ancestor to life on Earth, or perhaps was Earth the ancestor to life on Mars? We wouldn't be able to answer any of those questions because we have already fouled the test results, right?
Right.
They said that if we don't have strong policies, then scientists end up studying their own contamination rather than anything pertaining to the actual planet or moon or whatever it may be.
Yeah. So this sounds like they're looking out for the future. I mean, the goal here is just saying we want to be as careful as possible to make things as friendly as possible for future research.
Or you might say, we decided to send this team in to see how big this forest is. And the way we're figuring it out is we're cutting it all down as we go through. what was the point of that?
yeah, and it highlights how we don't have a second chance in these kinds of experiments.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like if we muck up the first Mars, there's a second Mars that we can just be like, oh, just throw that one out, go to the next one. I mean, and I guess the next one is like Europa or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes, that would not be what I would like to call scientifically great.
Well, yeah. It sounds like you've bought into that NASA shill line. You don't even accept the existence of anti-Mars.
Mars 2.
I'm a total anti-Mars denier. This web we've woven is very complex.
No, I'll tell you about anti-Mars sometime.
Oh.
It's always on the exact opposite side of the sun from Earth. That's why you don't see it.
I think my nose just started bleeding.
Is it flat? Is it a flat planet?
Flat Mars.
They're all flat planets.
Oh.
They all float down here. So This was one of those fun topics to kind of take a look at because it's
come up a lot before, but we've never gone into full depth.
Yeah, it's something that we've mentioned a few times, but we really wanted to kind of explore the whole question further. And I do side more on the caution part of the equation because
I think I do too.
Yeah, I get the frustration because we're at a stage now where we're capable of doing a lot more than we've ever done in the history of mankind, that the private space industry has boosted our ability to reach destinations far beyond what the official governmental backed bodies were able to do. Mm-hmm. But we can't allow that to just turn space into a new Wild West if we want to answer these questions. If we ultimately decide these questions aren't that important, then that's another factor. I will be very sad if that day comes, but
or that it's just physically impossible for us to answer them given
the constraints.
Given the constraints, yeah. Given that microbes are really determined to be places,
and it could even be that there could be microbes on Mars, but they might be in a very localized region, and unless we just happen to target that region by sheer luck, we never find it, right? That's a possibility. It's not necessarily likely, but it is possible that the evidence we're looking for is contained within a certain region on the planet, and that makes it even more tricky for us to get there before finally people are said, look, you had your chance. We're building a condo there.
Oh, we've got a lot of shallow frozen puddles to jump in if we're going to try to find the one with the microbes.
I think I just came up with an idea for a movie, and it's essentially The Martian meets Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo,
ooh,
where there's the development company that wants to come in and build Martian condos, and then there's the scrappy youth group that really want to protect the pristine environment of Mars, and they do it through breakdancing. Your stunned silence tells me.
I will be your Golden Globus.
Yeah, all I need you to do is promise you'll buy a ticket to the premiere. All right, so that kind of wraps up this discussion. If you guys have any thoughts about this, maybe you're thinking, you guys are making way too big a deal about this. Let me tell you why we should not worry about it. Or maybe you have a very passionate argument to protect the pristine nature of these places until we have definitively, or as close to definitively as possible, answered the questions we have. Write us and let us know. I want to hear your thoughts about it. Also, if you have any suggestions for future episodes, that kind of thing, get in touch with us. The email address to use is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on social media, like Twitter, where we are FW Thinking, or Facebook, where you search FW Thinking, we'll pop up. You can leave us a message there, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to a bit of optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.